He will be describing to us the implementation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty Safeguards Agreement in the Islamic Republic of Iran. And any resemblance to Alex Montgomery is purely coincidental.
John, let me make a suggestion that when we move to the actual briefing that you just cut the video, I'll cut mine, and that will probably help with the voice quality.
Sorry?
When you put up the presentation, I'm going to cut the video, and you should cut your video feed.
I'll cut my video there.
And that'll improve the audio, or hopefully it'll improve the audio quality.
If I just cut on this side, then that might be sufficient.
All right, let's see what we can do. So, all right, good afternoon. Let me just begin this talk with a statement which I now have to make, which is that the opinions expressed here on my own do not necessarily reflect those of the U.S. Department of Defense, the Council on Foreign Relations, or any affiliated organizations, nor have these opinions been approved or sanctioned by these organizations. I'm going to talk for somewhere between about half an hour and 40 minutes. If you have questions during the presentation, please feel free to ask them. I may have a hard time hearing you, so I'm going to rely on Dr. Chow to field the questions and to repeat them. Please try to speak clearly if possible. And you are welcome to ask questions on any subject, whether these are technical questions regarding the actual physics or engineering the processes. Knowledge of this is not necessarily needed, but it is very helpful in the negotiations themselves. So take notes. I will be posting this entire presentation up onto the Moodle at the very end of this, so you will have access to all the slides. If you have any further questions after this, you may email me as well. So that being said, let me move on to the presentation. All right. Esteemed delegates, the implementation of the NPT Safeguards Agreement in the Islamic Republic of Iran has been on the agenda of the Board of Directors of the IAEA since 2000 and on the agenda of the United Nations Security Council since 2006. Today I'm here to report to you on the outstanding issues. Next slide, please. I will divide my presentation into seven parts. First, I will give you an overview of the two main paths to nuclear weapons. This is the enriched uranium and the plutonium route. Next, I will discuss Iran's nuclear facilities and how far they are along each of those paths. It does not necessarily to imply that Iran has a nuclear weapons program, but merely to indicate that it has the capabilities, how far they are along in possessing the capabilities required in order to produce fissile material for use in a nuclear weapon. Then I will give you a brief overview of Iran's past failures, that is to say, some of the most recent and salient ones. A more hopeful note, I will then discuss some recent progress that has been made in the last year or so. I will then review the remaining outstanding issues the IAEA has been unable to resolve. Next, I will discuss further reading that will be very helpful for the delegates, and then I'll conclude with my hopes for this conference. Next slide, please. All right, there are two paths to the bomb, HEU and PU. Next slide. I should see a backhoe here. This is going to be represented on the next geographical map, which will indicate where each of Iran's nuclear facilities are. This is uranium mining and milling facilities. Mining facilities are merely essentially the process of digging uranium ore out of the ground. Milling is conversion of the raw uranium ore to what is commonly called yellow cake, or U308 for chemistry fans out there. After it is mined and milled, next slide, you should see a yellow barrow now, which will be used to represent uranium conversion facilities. The yellow cake can then be converted in one of two ways. One is that it can be converted into a form of uranium, which is particularly useful in fueling research reactors and power plants which are intended to create plutonium for nuclear weapons. That's the second path. I'll get to that as soon as I finish the uranium part. Or it can be converted into uranium hexafluoride, or hex. Uranium hexafluoride is a gas in certain states and can then be enriched in order to produce what is called weapons-grade uranium. Now, if you can move the next slide, you'll see a slide with what are... This is essentially a very abstract version of a series of pipes connecting a series of cylinders together. What the cylinders represent are the centrifuges. Now, uranium... contain natural uranium as you dig it up in the ground, only contains 0.7%, less than 1% of the fissile part of uranium, which is called uranium-235. The non-fissile part, or uranium-238, you essentially want to remove all of that so you are left with as much uranium-235 as possible. There are three enrichment levels which are relevant here. One is enrichment for commercial power plants. This is enrichment to 3-5% of uranium-235. The next level is about 20%. This is where we transition from what we call low-enriched uranium, which is 3-5%, to highly enriched uranium, which is 20% and higher. This is used in a number of research facilities for various different types of experiments. The third level, which is important, is weapons-grade uranium. This is where you get up to 80% uranium-235, which can then be used. Actually, practically anything above 20% in theory can be used for a nuclear weapon, but in practice, no one has or probably will build a bomb with anything less than 80% of uranium-235. Now, so these are the three important levels. Centrifuges, what happens in them is that these are cylinders. So uranium is a gas.
Can you repeat that, please?
Sorry.
Centrifuges?
Centrifuges. So centrifuges are cylinders, which are pictured or at least diagrammed above. You inject uranium hexafluoride, hex, gas into them. As you spin the centrifuges around at very high speeds, the heavier uranium-238 collects along the outer edges. The lighter uranium-235 tends to stay more in the middle. You then suck it out of that centrifuge and then put it in the next one, where it is further and further and further enriched until you get the desired enrichment level. Now, here's the important part about the different enrichment percentages. It may seem that 3-5% and 20% are not very enriched compared to 80%. This is true. But in terms of the work and effort required, once you've gotten all the way to 3-5%, you've already done more than half of the work or effort or energy, if even, required in order to get to weapons-grade uranium. This is because you consider enrichment to be the process of removing the stuff that you don't want, rather than, you know, just trying to extract the stuff that you do want. So in getting to 5%, what you're doing is you're effectively removing very, very large chunks of the uranium-238, the stuff that you don't want. So in some sense, it's like removing somewhere between three quarters and four-fifths of the uranium-238 just to get it to 5%. So you've already done somewhere around two-thirds or three-quarters or four-fifths of the work needed in order to get to high-enriched uranium, in order to get to weapons-grade uranium, once you have this 3-5% low-enriched uranium level. 20%, when you get to highly-enriched uranium, is even closer to it. You've removed almost all of the uranium-238 already, and you only need to remove a bit more in order to get all the way to the 80% or more weapons-grade uranium. This is why highly enriched uranium and even low enriched uranium is a threat. So it would take Iran, for example, they have a sufficient amount of 20% enriched uranium, that is to say this level for research reactors, in order to produce enough weapons-grade uranium in about 2 or 3 months, given their current facilities. So whereas it would take them much longer than a year to go from natural uranium of 0.7% of the fissile material all the way up to weapons-grade uranium. I'm going to pause here for just a moment to see if there are questions about that process.
And questions about the enrichment process, different percentages. Okay, everybody's clear?
No? Excellent.
Great.
All right, next slide. So instead, that's the uranium route to a nuclear weapon. The second route is the plutonium route. You can take the natural uranium, which you have gotten out of the uranium conversion, fabricate it into fuel, and place it into a nuclear reactor. This is not the kind of nuclear reactor we normally think of. It's not a power production reactor like most of the reactors in the U.S. It's not a light water reactor. The reactors which you can just put natural uranium into in order to produce plutonium.
Can you repeat that sentence one more time?
Yes. So nuclear power plants, ones that we produce in the U.S., typically run on low-enriched uranium. So you can't take natural uranium and just put it into a commercial power plant and expect it to produce plutonium. It just won't do it. Or at least it won't do it anywhere near fast enough to be important. But you can take low-enriched uranium, You can take uranium which has not been enriched at all. So you just dug it out of the ground and converted it, and you can place it into a heavy water power plant or a gas-cooled reactor in order to produce enough plutonium. Now, as it turns out, Iran is building, probably not by coincidence, a heavy water power plant, which can be used to convert natural uranium into plutonium. If you go to the next slide, there's a little sort of diagram of a it's actually the reactor cooling tower, technically speaking. And you need one which is, you know, sort of medium-sized, if you will. Something over, and that means megawatts thermal. So it's over 20 megawatts thermal for those physicists and people who have worked on the RAID reactor out there. The RAID reactor, of course, is much too small in order to produce a significant amount of plutonium. And if you go to the next slide, you'll see that there's a little, this is supposed to represent a reprocessing facility. So after you have taken your natural uranium, turned it into fuel, put it in a reactor, like a heavy water power plant, and left it there for about a year, and then extracted it, you can then extract the plutonium from the rest of the uranium and other fissile products which are left in the fuel rods. Now, this means that one of the indications of a weapons program is that you are actually trying to reprocess it instead of do something like, say, generate medical isotopes. What Iran says that they are doing with their 40 megawatt heavy water reactor is that they are producing medical isotopes. But there are two problems with this. One is that it is much too large. You would be producing medical isotopes for an entire region, a large chunk of the world with a medical isotope production facility that large. Second problem has to do with the reprocessing. If you are just producing medical isotopes, you don't need a whole lot of shielding because when you're producing them, it's not very radioactive. However, if you are reprocessing fuel from a reactor in order to get the plutonium out, then there's a lot of radiation, and you need glass, which is more than a meter thick. As it turns out, in 2003, Iran was seeking glass, which is more than a meter thick.
What year again?
2003.
Okay.
In 2003. So there is some question as to why Iran was seeking this, since they claim they're not reprocessing. By the way, the reason for the medical isotopes being less radioactive is you're not producing them in the fuel rods, you're putting additional targets around the reactor. So you don't have to reprocess entire fuel rods, you're just pulling these little targets you put inside the reactor out and then extracting the isotopes from them. So, to enrich the bomb, one is through enrichment, the other is the plutonium route through reprocessing. And I'll talk a little bit more about Iran-specific facilities in the next slide, but I'll pause for just a moment to see if there are any questions about the plutonium route.
You said it took 2 to 3 months to move from the uranium conversion stage to the enrichment stage. How long did it take through the other reducing reactor?
So it takes 2 to 3 months. If you already have some highly enriched uranium, 20% enriched, then it takes about 2 to 3 months if you take it and put it back into Iran's existing facilities to make one bomb's worth. Okay? That's because you're already starting from having produced, you've already partially enriched it.
Sorry, say that one more time, please.
You've already partially enriched the uranium, and so that's why it only takes 2 to 3 months from that point. If you start from natural uranium, given Iran's smaller facility, which I'll get to on the next slide, it would take about a year to produce one bomb's worth of weapons-grade uranium. So because they've already got some partially enriched uranium, it will only take them 2 to 3 months instead of a year per weapon. Now, Iran's 40-megawatt power plant in a year will produce about 2 bombs worth of plutonium. So they would need to wait a year for it to radiate, then you would extract it. It would take a few weeks in order to extract all the plutonium from it, and then you would have a nuclear weapon. So, in other words, Iran's facilities are sized such that the plutonium route, you would get about 2 bombs a year. Uranium enrichment, if you were starting from nothing and just using the small facility, which is built under a mountain so that it's difficult to bomb, then you would have about 1 a year. But if you start with 20% enriched uranium, you could get up to 4 somewhere between 4 to 6 a year out of that small facility.
Okay, so basically, with this particular, with a 40 megawatt reactor, they can produce about two bombs worth of fissile material. Of course, you know, that's just the fissile material. That doesn't say anything about the actual delivery device or anything like that.
That's correct. It's important to distinguish possession of materials from having a device. There are many engineering challenges involved in producing nuclear weapons, many of them having to do with the shaping of the metallic spheres. As it turns out, it's very difficult to shape uranium or plutonium into spheres properly. And so, as a result, the challenges are not only fissile materials. However, the importance of the materials part of it is that once they have the materials, it is easier to, in a clandestine manner, produce a nuclear weapon. The facilities for producing fissile materials tend to be very large and somewhat obvious. The very small design groups required for producing an actual device from fissile material, those are much easier to hide. Now, there was a report in 2007, a national intelligence estimate, by the United States, which stated that that Iran did have these weaponization parts of their program, but that this work stopped in 2003. Now, since then, there has not been another released national intelligence estimate which assesses anything other than that. So no one has said Iran has started efforts again. But, as I mentioned, it is much easier to hide these weaponization efforts than it is to hide these facilities for creating fissile materials in the first place. All right?
Any questions? Okay.
All right. Moving on to the next slide, the map of Iran. So this gives you a map of all of Iran's various facilities connected, which are potentially connected with their nuclear program, whether it's for weapons purposes or others. So the reason why there are some flags on here is that I wanted to indicate that there are a number of countries which have assisted Iran inadvertently or intentionally with their nuclear program. So you may be surprised to see, for example, that the U.S. has contributed towards a very small research reactor, which, by the way, is too small to produce plutonium for nuclear weapons in Tehran. Additionally, after the Iranian Revolution, when the U.S. refused to provide any additional fuel for said reactor, Argentina, in fact, ended up providing the fuel for that reactor instead. There are a number of other countries which have also contributed to Iran's nuclear complex. Russia has contributed, essentially built the Bushehr reactor, which you can see in the lower left-hand corner, for them. China assisted Iran with building all their uranium conversion facilities in Isfahan. And Pakistan, or the AQ Khan network, depending upon whether you believe that the AQ Khan network is really just Pakistan's government, or whether it was, in fact, a rogue scientist, if you will, contributed significantly towards assisting Iran with uranium enrichment facilities through producing blueprints, other diagrams, and a number of parts for their initial centrifuges, which they put into the plant. Now, there are, of course, power plant which is being built in Darkhoven, or at least in theory will be built there. There are a couple of uranium mining and milling facilities. These are somewhat less important as far as Iran's nuclear facilities. I should mention, the plutonium produced in one of these heavy water reactors is ideal for weapons use. The plutonium produced in the heavy water reactor, which Iran is building, is ideal for weapons use.
Sorry, you cut out again. Is that the plutonium produced at the heavy water reactor is
ideal for weapons use?
It's like the technology is conspiring against us, so we can't understand that.
It is ideal for weapons use.
Is it weapons grade or it is not?
It is weapons grade.
It is weapons grade. Okay.
Okay. The light water reactors all over the world also produce plutonium. However, the quality of the plutonium that they produce is much lower. You can still use it for a nuclear weapon. It's called reactor-grade plutonium. But in terms of a state which would want to build an arsenal which is reliable, they would always want to use the weapons-grade plutonium from something like the heavy water reactor rather than using the plutonium from a large commercial power plant. So it also takes a very different type of facility in order to reprocess a much larger, much more heavily shielded facility to reprocess fuel rods from these commercial power plants. So while it's possible, it's not desirable at all. The heavy water reactor, which Iran is building at Iraq, A-R-A-K, not I-R-A-Q, that's the country next door, is particularly well-suited for producing weapons-grade plutonium. In fact, it is often called a known bomb factory. It's the kind of design that you would ideally want to have if you wanted to make nuclear weapons. So that facility, that reactor, can produce about 2 bombs worth of weapons-grade plutonium per year. Iran also has 2 centrifuge facilities. One is a very large commercial facility at Natanz. That's the one sort of in the middle of the map, in which there are 2 separate centrifuge enrichment facilities. One is the fuel enrichment plant, FEP, which is planned to be very large. It's planned to have 54,000 centrifuges. Now, currently, it only has about 9,000 of them installed. And to give you an idea of how many bombs you can make in a year with 9,000 centrifuges, it takes somewhere between, depending upon how well they are operating, about 2,000 to 4,000 centrifuges. So let's say, let's take the average of that. So on average, this facility could produce about 3 nuclear weapons a year if you went straight all the way from natural uranium to weapons-grade uranium. Now, so far, it has produced a great deal of low-enriched uranium, about 6,800 kilograms, and has produced 124 kilograms of 20% enriched, highly enriched uranium. So, in addition to that, the FFEP, or the Fordow Fuel Enrichment Plant in Qom, in the sort of upper left-hand corner, they have about 3,000 centrifuges planned. This happens to match up very well, you will note, with the number of centrifuges you need to produce about 1 bomb's worth of plutonium, of highly enriched weapons-grade uranium in a year. Or alternatively, if you are starting with 20% enriched uranium, you can produce up to about 3 or 4 weapons a year using this facility, which coincidentally happens to be buried under a mountain, and so is very difficult to attack from the air. This facility has already produced around 60 kilograms of highly enriched uranium. So if you go to the next slide, you can see that there's a chart of the cumulative production of uranium enriched up to 5%. And you notice that it's steadily increasing over time, that the rate is also increasing over time of production. If you go to the slide after that, you'll see that the curve is even steeper for the amount of 20% enriched uranium which Iran has produced, and that they're all the way up to about 189 kilograms at this point of 20% enriched uranium. And if you do the math on that, you end up with somewhere between around 34 or 35 kilograms of weapons-grade uranium, which you could produce from that, which is enough for maybe 1 or 2 nuclear weapons. So they already have enough 20% enriched uranium to produce a couple of nuclear weapons if they were to feed that back into the centrifuges at the FFEP. All right, questions on that? Excellent.
Okay.
Let's go look at some satellite photos. Now I want to talk about some recent failures. So I want to focus first on the Fordow Fuel Enrichment Plant and then talk about the Parchin site. Fordow Fuel Enrichment Plant, this is a satellite photo from January of 2009, which indicates the tunnel entrances into the mountain, which were visible at that point. You can see earth spoils from increased excavations. There was increased activity around this time. If you go to the next slide after that, you will see what it then looked like in September of 2009. Just to say, the tunnel entrances have been covered up. It's very difficult to see them in this satellite photo. And that there's a new excavation which is going on, which they are actually covering up as they excavate it. Needless to say, this is highly suspicious for what is supposed to be a civilian facility. Moreover, there is work that has been apparent if you look back at satellite photos from 2002, 2004, and 2006, which is strange in that Iran has made this claim that they allocated this facility to the AEOI, or Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, in the second half of 2007. So it's suspicious that there was work going on here in three previous years. They've installed 3,000, or they plan to install about 3,000 IR1 centrifuges. They also have some more advanced centrifuges which they are working on, which you will read about in the IAEA reports, the IR2M and the IR4. These are more advanced ones in that they can, it requires a lower number of centrifuges. So it requires a fifth.
Say that one more time, Alex.
So these more advanced centrifuges are five times as efficient. So you would only need about 600 of those in order to produce one bomb's worth of weapons-grade uranium per year if you are starting with natural uranium.
And these are the IR2s?
The IR2s and the IR4.
IR2s and IR4.
Now, Iran is
having... haven't installed these yet, you're saying?
No, they've got a few of them installed in a pilot enrichment plant. Not this one, but one which is next to the Natanz facility. They're having a lot of problems, actually, with creating these due to the export controls which the world has placed on Iran. So, for example, the difference between the 2 and the 4 is that the 2... it's called a bellows. It's just a part of it which holds the two main parts of the centrifuge together. Its design calls for it being made out of something called Mar aging steel, which is a particularly strong alloy of steel. Now, Iran cannot produce this domestically, and so they have to import all of their supply of Mar aging steel. And due to export controls, they then had to redesign it again in the IR4, which is an all carbon fiber rotor. Now, there are a lot of, which is actually more difficult, the material isn't as easy to create these centrifuges out of. But export controls on carbon fiber have also prevented them from making a whole lot of these centrifuges. So it appears that this is going to take a long time for them to produce these more efficient centrifuges. Most of the parts of the IR-1 can be produced domestically in Iran. All right. So... the last point here I want to say about the enrichment facility is that they were in violation of their Code 3.1 of their safeguards agreements. Now, what Code 3.1 says is that you need, before you construct a nuclear facility which is going to be under IAEA safeguards, and I'll just mention that your mining and milling facilities do not have to be under safeguards. It's just the conversion facilities and the enrichment facilities and the reactors which are under safeguards.
What does not need to be covered under safeguards?
Mining and milling.
Sorry, one more time, please?
Mining and milling.
Alex, you keep on cutting out. Say it one more time. What kind of facility does not need to be covered under
safeguards? It's the first stage.
Okay, first stage. Those are the
mining.
The mining and conversion, you're saying?
Mining and milling.
I take that as a yes?
Yes.
okay. All right, we'll go ahead and proceed.
Okay. They're in violation. So Code 3.1 says that you have to provide them with Design Information Verification, or DIV is the acronym for this. This is an acronym-based organization, so you're going to have to get used to them. What Code 3.1 says is that before you build it, you have to give them the information. And Iran is in violation because... essentially, they built the facility without providing the information first. All right. Next slide, going on, talk about the Parchin site. So if you go one slide further, you'll see a mock-up of a test chamber. Parchin is a military site, or at least Iran claims it's a military site, and therefore there's no reason why the IAEA would have to do anything with it. However, we know, the IAEA knows through reports, by the way, the IAEA does not have its own intelligence gathering arm. It relies on intelligence from all sorts of member states, which Iran is often very upset about, and that other states have been divulging information about Iran. So in any case, there was a test chamber which was placed there in 2000. Now, this test chamber is very good for, and is, in fact, the main thing it's good for, is for testing nuclear weapons designs, particularly something called hydrodynamics. And what it's testing is it's testing the implosion part of that. We also know that between 1996 and 2002 that there was a foreign expert who is merely referred to as the foreign expert in the IAEA documents, who is an expert in these types of test chambers and explosions, who has testified to the test chamber's existence and his assistance, which he gave in setting up the test chamber. So we know that the site exists, we know that there was this chamber in it, and the IAEA requires access to it in order to verify that the test chamber was not in fact used for weaponization, for testing of weapons designs. Now if you go to the next slide, you'll see one of the problems here, and that this is a satellite photo of the site around the building in which the test chamber was placed. And so we have seen earth-moving machinery, there's debris from a building which was demolished, and there was water flowing from near the building, which we suspect may be Iran trying to decontaminate and clean up the site so that the IAEA cannot, in fact, detect anything which is going on in that particular area. So the IAEA particularly urges Iran to give the IAEA access as soon as possible so that we can, in fact, verify that there was or was not a test chamber that was used for this type of testing. All right, next slide, please. On a more positive note, there's been some recent progress. In February, Iran agreed to take part in six-party talks with France, Germany, the UK, China, Russia, and the United States. In March, they agreed on a conditional visit to Parchin on behalf of the IAEA. Sadly enough, neither of these events has actually happened in practice. So Iran has said that it does not want the IAEA to visit Parchin until the current structured approach which the IAEA is negotiating with Iran is finished. The IAEA, since January of 2012, has had an intense dialogue and has been working with Iran on creating the structured approach. However, there are a number of issues which have still not been properly resolved. And at the latest meeting between the IAEA and Iran, these issues were still unresolved. Additionally, the six-party talks did not take place. I'm hopeful that they will. And this conference, as an independent meeting of countries outside of the UN, the IAEA, and the six-party talks, the hope is that we will be able to move the ball forward on this and to have Iran engage at a deeper level with the IAEA and with the six parties mentioned. All right, next slide, please.
Alex, can you just elaborate a little bit more on what this structured approach means?
Well, unfortunately, because this document is confidential, I can't go into the details. But essentially, if you look at the late 2011 report, which I believe has been placed on the Moodle website, or there's a link to it, has in the annex has a long list of issues which the IAEA would like to resolve. And the structured approach is essentially that same list and an ordering in which Iran will go through and agree to certain conditions in which it will, for example, allow the IAEA to meet with members of its nuclear its nuclear facilities. The IAEA has requested meetings with so that the IAEA can verify that those individuals were not working on weaponization. Some of them are physical facilities, such as going to Parchin. You can more or less simply, the structured approach is essentially that list with an ordering, and we're attempting to negotiate limits. So for some items, the Iran has agreed you may interview the following people. For some sites, Iran has agreed you may visit them. So for example, the IAEA is able to visit the Fort Al fuel enrichment plant and the Natanz plant, and it has been able to make one visit to the constructed heavy water reactor, but the IAEA requires more visits than that, and has refused access to the heavy water plant, which produces the heavy water which will go in the reactor. And of course, Parchin, it is mostly and entirely refused IAEA access. And time is of the essence here, obviously, for at least two reasons. One is that the longer it takes, the less evidence will be available at these sites for the IAEA to be able to verify. And the second piece is that the longer that it takes Iran to negotiate, the more enriched uranium Iran will possess, and the more nuclear weapons Iran could potentially produce if it decided to divert all of that material into producing nuclear weapons. Now, let me just say that all of that material is under IAEA safeguards. If any of it went missing, we would know within a very short period of time. Iran would effectively have to kick out the IAEA inspectors in order to be able to divert that material. Now, so the IAEA can verify that all of the material which Iran has produced is under safeguards. What the IAEA cannot do is verify any occurrences at any other facilities in Iran, to the extent that we would like to be able to do so. So that is what the structured approach is about, is resolving all these weaponization issues. Now, there are separate issues that I'll get to if we can move to the next slide, which has a picture of a hemisphere on it. This is a useful way of me talking about this, about the additional issues on top of access to particular sites. So the first one is that the Iranians have rolled back their safeguards all the way back to 1976. Now, there are no other states which are currently under safeguards which were agreed to in the mid-70s. They have unilaterally suspended Code 3.1 of their safeguards agreement, which is DIV, or the Design Information Verification part. Now, this is crucial because you're not allowed to do that under IAEA rules. You cannot simply suspend some part of your safeguards agreement. You can refuse to sign a new agreement, of course, but you cannot simply abrogate an agreement. So they are in violation of Code 3.1 of their safeguards, even though they claim that because they have rolled back to 1976, they are not actually required to share information about any facilities before they build them. Let me add on top of this that Iran has announced that they will build 10 more enrichment facilities, and has said that they have selected sites for 5 of them, but have shared none of this information with the IAEA. So we're very concerned about these this popping up of enrichment sites all over Iran. The second part is that we also need an additional protocol.
The second part is what?
We need an additional protocol. So the additional protocol is a much more stringent set of safeguards, which allows, the most important part of which is that it was allow the IAEA to enter into, on very short notice, any facility where it is suspected that nuclear activities are taking place. So currently, the IAEA can only go to a certain number of facilities. It has no rights anywhere else in the country. Now, a number of countries have signed an additional protocol indicating that the IAEA may do so. Iran signed the additional protocol in 2003, but did not ratify it and has not been compliant with it either. This is crucial to being able to verify that Iran is, in fact, compliant with safeguards and is not attempting to acquire nuclear weapons, is this additional protocol. All right. So with respect to the items that need clarification, I'm just going to give you 3 bullet points here, and you should go and look at the annex more in depth to get the full list. But here are the items which we are most concerned about. The first one is this uranium metal document. In the late 1980s, Iran was given a document by the AQCON network which involved how to shape uranium into spheres. Now, unless Iran is going to start a nuclear bowling league, there is no other use for uranium spheres other than pits for nuclear weapons. So this is a very highly suspicious document, and the IAEA would like a copy of the document, would like to know about the origins of it, where it came from, where it's been, what it's been used for. The second item is procurement and production by military-related industries. So there are a number of military-related industries that have been attempting to procure lots of dual-use technologies, which is to say things that can be used both for civilian and military purposes. This, of course, is odd in that if Iran's program is solely civilian, why are military industries procuring items which are nuclear-related? Third item is weaponization and delivery system studies, and if you could go to the next slide here, you should see a very colorful table related to one particular aspect of weaponization. Now, there were designs which were given to the IAEA of nose cones for ballistic missiles. The IAEA asked its experts to go through and to attempt to determine what sort of different purposes these nose cones could be put to. And this table gives you an idea. Red indicates that it is very likely that that this information is would be commensurate with that particular type of nose cone, whether it's nuclear, satellite, or biological chemical weapons. Obviously, the latter two are also not good. Nonetheless, you can see from this table very clearly that that all of the information we have about this nose cone design is that it seems to very strongly indicate that the use is a nuclear use and not any of these other possible uses. Among other weaponization studies, you can read all about them in the annex. Finally, compliance. Iran is out of compliance with both its IAEA obligations and the demands of the UN Security Council. In order to be in compliance, Iran would have to do the following. It would have to suspend enrichment. It has not suspended enrichment for almost 8 or 9 years now. It's been continuously enriching despite the requests of the IAEA and the UN Security Council to suspend enrichment. They've been requested to suspend construction of the heavy water reactor and the Fordow fuel enrichment plant. They have done neither. They've been asked to give the IAEA access to the heavy water plant, that is, the plant that produces heavy water. They have not done that. And, of course, very crucially, as I discussed before, access to the Parshan site. So until they are in compliance with their obligations, as a result of that, there have been that Iran is currently under a great deal of economic sanctions. If we go to the next slide. Here's some further reading that I suggest on this. You see on the right-hand side, UN Security Council Resolution 1929. This is the latest of a series of resolutions. You might want to look at the rest of them, but this one more or less summarizes the others and updates the status of the current status of the sanctions. On the left-hand side is the Board of Governors report on Iran. You should look at both the one from last November and the most recent one, which should be the next slide, which gives you the latest updates on Iran's status with respect to its NPT safeguards agreement. So you should look at both of these documents to get a sense of the most current situation. A lot of my presentation here is focused on those, but you can get the full details in those in those resolutions and the and reports. All right. Final slide. Okay. So, as I have indicated in the past, all of the nuclear material declared by Iran to the agency has been accounted for. And, apart from the small quantities previously reported to the board, there have been no further findings...
Alex, sorry, we're losing you, Alex.
You are. All right. Any better?
Can you just call me back? Maybe reset connection?
All right, I'll try that. Actually, hang on. Let me try something else for a moment here. Is that any better? Yep. Is that any better? Okay. Yes. Now. Good. Better. All right, let's try that for a bit. It's all right. We're near the end. We are at the end, in fact. So, let me just finish up saying. So we've been able to account for everything, all the nuclear material in Iran, but we cannot account for anything else. We can't account for these weaponization studies. We can't account for any material at any sites that we don't know about or Iran has not declared to us. So it is crucially important for that Iran not only comply with the UN Security Council resolutions, but also, as soon as possible, ratify and implement the additional protocol. So, finally, I remain hopeful that through the ongoing dialogue at this conference, that the conditions will be created to engage in a negotiation for a comprehensive settlement that would address both the international community's concerns about the peaceful nature of Iran's nuclear program and addressing Iran's economic, political, and security concerns. Finally, I wanted to say that we are grateful to Reed College for allowing us to use their facilities for this important diplomatic conference, and feel it is doubly appropriate due to Reed's research reactor program that demonstrates the peaceful uses of nuclear technology, as you can see in the lower left-hand corner. So I wish you the best of luck. I know we only have a couple minutes left, but I'm happy to answer any questions which you have. you have any additional questions, you are welcome to email me at any time, and I will answer them to the best of my ability. So, thank you. Certainly.